Oh yes, got it. Recording. So you can see my screen now?
Yes, we can.
Good. So I have to apologize that this was so long in coming, this journal club. It was articles from April and I should have presented it in May. So thank you for letting me delay it. April was slim pickings for a lot of articles on pulmonary and thoracic pathology, but I think I found some interesting ones. The first one I'm going to talk about is the one by Kishikawa, talking about distinct properties of pure and mixed type high-grade fetal lung adenocarcinomas. Now, just a bit of background, we know these are extremely rare adenocarcinomas, and they have very, very typical morphology. The diagnosis is based on their morphology generally. We have these very complex branch-forming tubular glands, and it looks like the pseudoglandular stage of the fetus, and that's why it's called fetal lung adenocarcinoma. And it's divided into two different types. And they also look a lot like early secretory endometrium. It's rich in glycogen. I think that's a definite thing you have to have, is glycogen. You have low grade, I'm going to call it FLAC, fetal lung adenocarcinoma. So there's a low grade and a high grade. And generally the low grade is homogenous and pure, the cases that have been described. And it's based, it's very similar morphology, but it's low nucleotypia. And these prominent morrels, which are these cell clusters consisting of spindle to oval shaped cells. It does have mitotic rates. It can have necrosis, but it's still described as low grade because it only has a small amount of necrosis. And they've been shown to have recurrent CTNNB1 mutations with aberrant nuclear accumulation of beta catenin. And it's usually young to middle aged women. And then the high grade FLAC is included in adenocarcinoma with other types of adenocarcinoma, but must be at least 50% high grade FLAC present. And in this, there is prominent nuclear atypia. There's no moral formation. There's often nucleoli present, a lot of mitosis and necrosis, and many other types of conventional lung adenocarcinoma present. And the beta catenin, importantly, is membrane localized and not in the nucleus. And it predominantly occurs in elderly men. Now, the author said the unanswered questions are, what is the prevalence of high-grade fetal adenocarcinomas in the general population? Is the high-grade FLAC a distinct variant of lung adenocarcinoma? And they also want to look at the clinical pathological differences between the pure type and those that were mixed with conventional adenocarcinoma. And then they made the comment that most of the global literature comprises case reports and case series. Well, this case series had fewer numbers than some others. So really they're just adding to the literature. I don't think this is the definitive study by any means, but still I think it was interesting. So the objectives were to determine the prevalence and the genetic and transcriptional characteristics of low-grade, pure, and mixed-type high-grade FLAC. So they screened the archives of their department over 10 years, and they got 3,895 cases. And I think, they didn't say specifically, but I think they reviewed all the cases, and two pathologists reviewed them. So if they did, that's a lot of work, but they didn't make that clear. But I wouldn't be surprised if they did. And they made the diagnoses. They also did immunohistochemistry, NGS, and nanostring. One failing in a way compared to some of the other studies was that they didn't macro dissect up the mixed tumors, because in the other studies for molecular, they macro dissected out the mixed tumors, or they could have just done a punch, I suppose. So the molecular is the whole tumor, not just the flak area. So I think the most useful table was table S2, which I hope this isn't too small. I hope you can see this. Which showed all 11 patients that they got. So the percentage was 0.3% of their population over 10 years. And it showed the age range and the different types of tumor. So the first two, one and two, were the low grade FLAC. So that's a pure one, so 100% fetal type morphology. This is the tumor size. Mitoses were relatively low. This is in 10 high power fields. They were all low grade, and they all had the CTNNB1 mutation. Then from here to here is, sorry, from the next two, sorry, three and four are pure high-grade FLAC. And there were only two of them as well, but they're interesting in that they're pure. And interestingly, also I should have just make a point that the low-grade FLAC wasn't young women that supposedly it occurs in more often. It was in older men, 63 and 75. The high-grade FLAC, one of these was a 41-year-old female, but the other one was a male of 74. And these were 100% pure FLAC. But look at these mitoses, 75 and 30. So one of them was very high in the woman and not so high in the male. And then the rest of them, the rest of the total was 11. So the rest of the seven were high-grade FLAC mixed with other types of adenocarcinoma. These ones from 5 to 9 counted as high-grade FLAC because they were 50% or more percentages of tumor. And they were older males and a few females. And then there were two cases that were less than 50%, 20% and 10%. Again, older people. So they made the comment pure type high-grade FLAC were younger than those with mixed type high-grade. Well, that's nonsense because if you average it out, yeah, they were 41 and 74 might be a little bit less, but there was one 41-year-old, one 74-year-old. So throughout this paper, they made these comments based on ends of two. They also said that pure high-grade fetal adenocarcinoma had higher mitotic counts. So if you look here, one had, as I mentioned, the 41-year-old woman had 82, but the other person had 18. So, that's tumor size. Mitosis, 75 and 30. So they were quite high, but I think it's 30 was in the range of the others. But that one stood right out. So they make these kind of blanket statements. There was tumor necrosis in most cases, and low-grade FLAC only had chameleon-like necrosis, but many of the others had geographic necrosis. So immunohistochemistry, they did a whole range of antibodies, but they considered samples positive when more than 1% of the tumor cells were stained, which seems a little bit surprising that if 1% stained, you think you might grade it, but that was what they used. For beta-catenin, a nuclear pattern in more than 10% was called positive. And they did the oncofecal markers. Glypican 3 was positive in one case and two cases of mixed type. And AFP was positive in only one. SMARC-A4 and SMARC-B1 were both intact. So there's just an image of how the beta-catenin staining occurred, looked. So this is one of the low-grade FLACs, and you can see that the morules, these are the morules, the areas where there's just the solid area of oval spindle-shaped cells, was positive for nuclear beta-catenin, whereas the tubules was membranous, although some of them had nuclear catenin as well. And then this is the high-grade FLAC area. All of these were positive for membranous catenin, membranous beta-catenin. And it's interesting, there was a paper looking at this in fetal lung, and in fetal lungs, beta-catenin is positive in areas where the tubules are sprouting. So it does look like it's one of these early things that happens in the fetus as well. This is a useful figure. All the cases are lined up at the top and then various things are at the bottom, which makes it easy to see. So you can see clearly that most of them were males in the green. There were a few females. The age was generally more than 60. Smoking index was high in many of them. There was only two recurrences, and they were all alive at the end of the study. It wasn't a very long period of time that they looked at patients, I think 49 months, but they were still all alive. Percentage fetal component, histological categories were in here, moral formation, high-grade nuclei, tumor necrosis, and then you can see the CTNNB1 is positive in the low-grade FLAC and in one of the cases of high-grade FLAC. EGFR was positive in that one as well. And there are a few other mutations present. The pure high-grade FLAC, though, had no mutations detected, no targetable mutations at all, and none other than, and no non-targetable, I suppose you could say. I didn't mention SEL4. That was positive in some of the cases and not others, so I don't think it's a very useful one according to this study. Interestingly, TTF1 was negative in the high-grade FLAC, the pure high-grade FLAC, not in the mixed ones. And it was positive in nearly all of them except one. And then CDX2 was positive in the high-grade FLAC, the pure high-grade FLAC, but also in some of the other ones. And then HNF4-alpha also followed CDX2. It seemed to be positive in the high-grade FLAC as well, the pure high-grade FLAC. So the molecular analysis, there were no mitogenic driver mutations in pure high-grade FLAC. I mentioned the CTNNB1 mutations, which were expected to be found. All cases were positive for membranous ecadherin, because that's a marker that they thought might be low in high-grade FLAC. There were no kinase fusions detected, and it was microsatellite stable. Then they made these other conclusions at the end. The prevalence of pure high-grade FLAC may be as high as that of low-grade FLAC based on ends of two. There were no genetic alterations that could activate Wnt signaling in the pure high-grade FLAC that they could find. They also said that TTF1 was frequently commonly expressed. But the pure high-grade FLAC lacked TTF1 expression. And this was similar to a previous study where there were a total of four cases of pure high-grade FLAC. So these are very rare tumors. And in this paper also said that TTF1 was negative. So that's interesting. So they conclude that mixed high-grade FLAC, as well as lung adenocarcinoma with high-grade FLAC features, may fundamentally constitute conventional lung adenocarcinoma with a characteristic morphological pattern rather than a specific tumor entity, whereas pure type high-grade FLAC is genetically and transcriptionally distinct from mixed type high-grade FLAC, which I think might be true, but I don't think we've got enough cases to be sure of that. The limitations were limited observation time, small numbers of genes analyzed using NGS, although they did analyze most driving mutations that have been positive in high-grade FLAC, as in these previous papers, which was this paper here. So any questions on that?
Margaret, so what was their evidence that it's distinct? I mean, they had limited molecular data on these, so I don't quite get how they can come to that conclusion.
Because of the TTF1 staining, which on an N of two.
Yeah, but we see tons of adenocarcinomas that don't have TTF1, right?
Yes,
so,
yes, exactly.
So it would be hard to pick these out by that immunophenotype. So
And they didn't pick up anything in the molecular side here, but then a lot of these other tumors were negative as well. So it's
wishful
not
thinking.
Pardon?
It looks like wishful thinking to me.
Wishful thinking, I think so, yeah. I think it's interesting because maybe high-grade FLAC is a distinct kind of tumor, but that's, you know, we wait to see that because low-grade FLAC is a distinct tumor. It's pure, right? So high-grade pure FLAC might be a distinct tumor, but there's too few to know if it's true or not because it's so rare. Yeah. Okay, I'm going to get on to the next paper, and I'm breaking the rules here because I'm going to talk about a review. This is more of a review paper than anything else, But when I read it, I found it very interesting, and I wanted to discuss it with you all. So as you know, I'm just going to, I can't make my screen. All right, I won't bother showing, but I did put in the other, there are two other reviews that I put in the Dropbox, the reviews that this paper is discussing. So they're older reviews. One was from 2020, which was the ATS diagnosis of HP guidelines with the first author of Raghu. And then the 2021 first author was Fernandez, and that was 2021. And that was, those are the CHEST guidelines. So this paper, final author was Bill Travis, and Tom Colby was on this as well, Andrew Cherg, Fernandez, and I think Raghu was somewhere in here as well. But really what they're doing is discussing those two, discussing the CHEST review, which is interesting because a review discussing a review and guidelines, but I find it interesting because I think this is such a difficult area, as they say here, assessment of lung biopsies for the diagnosis of hypersensitive pneumonitis, which I'm going to call HP, is very challenging because as we know, there's often no offending antigen that we can find, even with an extremely detailed history. And then there's also lack of consensus about clinical, radiological, and pathological features of HP. So I guess what they're trying to do here is get more consensus. So they looked at these two different guidelines. They basically looked at the one with Fernandez-Perez, and then they compared it to the ATS one as well. So as we know, we generally describe HP as fibrotic or non-fibrotic. So the non-fibrotic could be called cellular as well. But once there's fibrosis, then the prognosis is quite different, and it's separated into that. They also make the comment that peribronchiolar metaplasia is a non-specific reaction to bronchial and peribronchiolar injury. But if it's affecting more than 50% of bronchioles, it should raise the consideration for fibrotic HP. We'll talk about that. I just want to ask your opinion about that. And as you know, in the CHEST guideline, there's four diagnostic criteria. There's typical, non-fibrotic, or fibrotic. So you divide it into the fibrotic, non-fibrotic, and then you go typical. They describe it compatible with, then the other group is indeterminate for, and then there's alternative diagnosis. And then I just copied and pasted these. They had these tables, but the tables from the original paper were nicer. So they're really useful tables, I think. Where you've got these four categories and they say why they include them or don't. And basically the difference between typical non-fibrotic, sorry, that's typical. I'm not interested in non-fibrotic right now. I'm more interested in the fibrotic. I find that more difficult. But in both of them, it's the presence of granulomas that makes it typical. So in both cases, fibrotic and non-fibrotic. So if you look down here, major features in fibrotic, all three major features in at least one of the sample lobes. So you've got to have small airway-centered fibrosis with or without peribronchiolar metaplasia. You've got to have fibrosing interstitial pneumonia affecting at least one lobe. With all these different, you can have these different patterns, NSIP fibrosing pattern, UIP pattern, difficult to classify pattern, solely peribronchiolar, and then poorly formed non-caseating granulomas. And all of these are present in the compatible with, but you don't have the non-caseating granulomas present. So those are the major findings. And then they divide them into minor features. The ATS classification didn't divide into major or minor. So here they talk about minor features include organizing pneumonia, small foci. We know that's very common in HP. Focal peribronchiolar metaplasia, if it's only focal, that's called a minor. If it's widespread, it's probably more important. Foamy macrophages, cholesterol clefts, you know, we've seen those a lot in HP, but also in other ILDs. And then lack of features of an alternative diagnosis, which is this column here. So there's other features that could give you the diagnosis. So I won't go on over this, but the other thing I wanted to mention is that they talk about indeterminate. So cases that show a pattern of fibrosing interstitial lung disease that does not meet the criteria for obviously any of these others, but there's uncertainty about the histological features in these cases that raise the consideration of fibrotic HP, as well as other differential diagnoses that become part of the multidisciplinary discussion. So this is obviously one that you really need the MDD discussions for. So fibrotic NSIP and UIP patterns are in this category. So it could be HP, but it could equally be something else. And this is what's different from the ATS guidelines, because they don't talk about indeterminate. They do talk about that. The difference between the ATS guidelines is that they don't have compatible with, they talk about probable in this group here. So I just wanted to show you one of the illustrations they had of what they call the typical fibrotic HP. And just looking at this, I thought, how can this be typical? Because to me, I would be really worried about UIP here, because I see a lot of subpleural fibrosis. And I know in UIP, you can, not UIP, but UIP related to IPF. So I think this is quite a UIP looking pattern. I have to be very careful how I say this, because the terminology can be so confusing, and we can say one thing and we mean something else. So I'm trying to say, so if I talk about UIP, obviously I'm not saying it's IPF or HP, but to me, this is a UIP pattern, very close to a UIP pattern. And a UIP pattern on its own could be anything, as we know. It could be HP, it could be IPF, it could be connective tissue disease related cause. So here they have subpleural fibrosis, extensive remodeling of the lung architectures, the arrows, bands of fibrosis showing bridging patterns between bronchioles. So there's bridging, but you can get bridging, bridging is part of a UIP pattern as well. Multiple fibroblastic foci. B shows fibrosis and mild chronic inflammation surrounding the bronchiole. But that doesn't mean, in UIP, you can get a lot of inflammation as well. And it can be bronchiolar. Pauliform granulomas were present. And I remember when I was at the Mayo Clinic many years ago, Kevin Leslie was looking at how many granulomas do you get in IPF versus HP. And if you find the odd granuloma in the lung, does that make it HP, one or two granulomas? Because these lungs are very damaged. We know there's a lot of cholesterol clefts from obstruction. There were pauliform granulomas. I guess it depends how many. Extensive, patchy, dense interstitial fibrosis is present with a subpleural distribution in a pattern that is difficult to classify, with some bronchiocentricity. Fibroblastic foci were also present. So, and then there was a pauliform granuloma, which is difficult to find. So this to me, this is a UIP pattern, and this is not typical fibrotic HP to me. It could be fibrotic HP. It depends on what the radiology shows to me and the clinical history. And in the same figure, but they also mentioned peribronchiolar metaplasia was widespread. So I didn't really see it up here, but I think elsewhere, affecting each of the bronchioles in this image. And here we have more. So I think this makes it more likely to be HP because of the widespread peribronchiolar metaplasia. But this doesn't make it HP. It's just one of the clues to, maybe I'd say this is more like HP because of the widespread peribronchiolar metaplasia. So what do people think about that? Do you agree that's typical fibrotic HP? Would you call that typical fibrotic HP?
Without E and F, possibly not. I might suggest it, but I don't know if I would go just on my bottom line, fibrotic HP.
Yeah.
It would be a tough one.
I think I would say this pattern, I think this is a UIP pattern with some features of bronchiocentricity. Maybe it's not your typical classic UIP pattern, I guess. And then maybe I would say the peribronchial metaplasia. And then if the granulomas are quite easy to find, then that I would mention that that might tip me over a bit. But I think this is one of these ones where you've got to have radiology and history. And then what if the radiology said, this looks like IPF, and there was no history of an antigen, then what do you do?
I mean, I'm trying to be quiet because I've expressed multiple opinions about the guidelines for this diagnosis. And I think it's a really important problem. And I think it's great that there are two sets of guidelines, which are mostly, they don't differ. And the pathology is almost identical.
Yeah.
But to be honest, I think MDD is becoming the problem. It's the new reference standard, and it's heavily influenced by pretest assumptions. And it's remarkable the frequency with which pathology is disregarded altogether. Mm-hmm. And yet the evidence remains very clear on one point. And that is, if the biopsy looks like UIP, whatever you conclude at MDD, it will behave very much like IPF. And, you know, if you combine that with the fact that fewer than 50% will have an identifiable antigenic exposure, and given the really non-specificity of the radiology, which everyone treats like it has a positive predictive value that is not borne out by the literature, mm-hmm. I think it's a mess. So for what it's worth.
No, thank you. I agree with that. That's exactly how I feel about it. Yeah.
There was a letter about the ATS guidelines from the Japanese group. Takai was first author, that I think is kind of symbolic of the mess. And they took the same cohort of patients that had been well studied and filtered them through the IPF guidelines. And, you know, about half had IPF and half didn't. And they took the same patients and filtered them through the HP guidelines, and some had fibrotic HP and some didn't. But there was this group of patients in whom they got conflicting signals, thought to be IPF when filtered through the IPF guidelines and fibrotic HP when filtered through the HP guidelines. And what was striking about that is they provided enough detail. It was a letter, so it didn't have a lot of detail, but they supplied enough detail to show that about a third of their patients that were thought to have IPF by MDD either had typical HP on a biopsy or probable HP on a biopsy. And I would argue, well, to the extent I understand the IPF guidelines, I don't know how they concluded they had IPF, yeah. Except they simply disregarded the pathology. But yeah. the bottom line is, if you look at the survival curves, it didn't really matter whether they thought they had fibrotic HP or not. Their survival curve was exactly the same as those with IPF. So mm-hmm. I feel like we're dancing on the head of a pin, and we've gone from underdiagnosing HP to now calling it HP anytime the radiologist says there's mosaic attenuation or a triple density sign. And I think that's probably not very smart.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. We still don't know what these are in the end.
Thanks, Jeff.
Sorry?
Well, first of all, thanks, Jeff, and thanks for your discussion at the PPS, you know, about this topic. And I think the other problem with guidelines is no patient lives in isolation from all the other stuff that happens in their body. So, you know, I was in New York recently, you know, a couple of years ago, talking about HP, and they've got a high frequency of patients who have IPF who have concomitant MAC. Right. So, you know, I think we interpret these granulomas sometimes as meaning, well, it's always got to be HP, but there's a lot of other stuff going on. Aspiration, you know, that is increased in patients with fibrotic lung disease. And so, you know, I think it really is a challenge. And I don't, you know, I don't have the MDD experience because we don't do a regular MDD, but I get what Jeff is saying, and sometimes the loudest voice in the room is the one that's going to hold sway, regardless of what the pathology shows.
She's always a clinician in our case, so. Yeah, well, thank you for those comments. I won't go into detail here because we don't have very long, but so this is a case that was compatible with, and it's just interesting, idiopathic pulmonary fibrosis is excluded by bronchial eccentricity and CT features. So again, it doesn't matter what the pathology showed. I guess they call this a UIP pattern. They didn't call the other one a UIP pattern. And then here, so just, so indeterminate for fibrotic HP. In this review, in the chest review, chest criteria, as I mentioned, it doesn't meet the criteria for all the other things, but it is associated with clinical radiological findings that suggest fibrotic HP. So indeterminate, this is an indeterminate case, again, a UIP pattern. However, bronchial eccentricity and granulomas were absent, so that paying a lot of attention to that, but I can see some bronchial eccentric inflammation right here. So anyway, the radiology looked like HP, so they call this HP. So it's exactly what you said, Jeff. It's kind of like, doesn't matter what the pathology shows, as long as it could be one or the other and CT says something, well, that's what we're gonna call it. But I wish Tom was here because he was on this review as well. I'd like to hear his comments. Here's the indeterminate for fibrotic HP. So if you have indeterminate for fibrotic HP by surgical lung biopsy, but typical fibrotic HP by CT, here's a case. It looks like fibrosing NSIP. There was no bronchial eccentric distribution. It looked just like fibrotic NSIP, but CT was typical HP. So this was then called indeterminate for fibrotic HP because there were no features that pointed towards HP. But this is one that I actually would feel more confident or saying was HP actually because the CT was just so typical and the pattern, this could be a sampling issue in the pathology. Anyway, so challenges of multidisciplinary diagnosis. So they made the comment, some patients with typical features of fibrotic HP on CT may show only NSIP or UIP pattern on biopsy. So basically, then it's fibrotic HP, assuming no antigen is identifiable. Well, I said I was more confident. I was more comfortable with this just in that. I think that maybe I should have said that. Maybe I'm not that comfortable. Because here we have the CT saying this is HP, but we've got no evidence on biopsy. But then again, it could be a sampling issue. But I guess that's why they called it indeterminate. And then conversely, some patients with typical NSIP or UIP pattern on CT may have histological findings of HP. So then is the diagnosis fibrotic HP? They didn't say what they said here. So if we've got histological findings of HP, does that make it HP? I'm assuming that does, even though the CT says this is typical NSIP or UIP. So I'm assuming that does. So I'm happy with that. That's what I'm happy with, that it's probably HP. And then the comparison with the ATS guidelines. So the main difference is that the chest guidelines use compatible rather than probable, and there's an argument why not. I agree with that argument. I think compatible is better than probable, but I won't go into that. I won't go into any of these here. You could read them later if you want. Also, the ATS criteria don't talk about UIP pattern. They describe patterns that are UIP, but they don't mention UIP. They kind of reserve UIP for IPF. But I think most people agree that UIP can be, and it doesn't make it.
And just to be clear, we struck that term after a reviewer 3 iterations said that we had to delete it. So we had a reviewer who really didn't like that term included in the manuscript, which was included in the first few. Yeah.
Right. Also, bridging fibrosis can be seen in IPF. So bridging fibrosis isn't specific for HP. I think that's important. And then they talk about how chest highlights the importance of the chronic inflammation around alveolar ducts, not just bronchioles. So I think that's, I don't know, I'm not sure if I would actually be able to see alveolar ducts, not just bronchioles. I look at that general area. I don't worry about if exactly where they are. And then just a few more things about this. So the surgical lung biopsy, chest guidelines and expert panel reports suggest considering histological lung biopsy when all available data do not yield a confident diagnosis and results may help guide management. But this was qualified as weak recommendations with very low quality evidence. But it's interesting that the MDD-ILD is also weak recommendations with very low quality evidence of it being of any value. So, so the reasons for having a surgical lung biopsy, I think quite often there isn't a confident diagnosis, but in our MDD-ILD rounds, they decide not to do a biopsy the majority of times. And they go on all sorts of things like, well, the BAL had a few lymphocytes in it, so I think it's HP, this kind of thing. And so we end up not getting biopsies. We don't have surgical lung biopsies in our institution, maybe one every 2 or 3 months for ILD, that's it. Because our clinicians, our surgeons are very keen to do it, but our clinicians don't want to. So they say, while typical features of non-fibrotic HP may occasionally be present in cases of fibrotic HP, 25 to 30% of cases will lack identifiable granulomas. So I don't think it's clear. I think they're saying that majority, more than 70% will have granulomas or giant cells. So I don't know about this, but this is non-fibrotic HP. So granulomas are more common in non-fibrotic HP. I'm not sure if I agree with that statement, if it's true. They also say peribronchiolar metaplasia, particularly when over 50% is a helpful diagnostic clue, generally favoring HP, but in one study, 33% of patients with clinical IPF were found a significant bronchiocentric fibrosis. So with everything else, everything is a soft sign that you have to put together. And then they also made the comment that fibrotic HP with a pure UIP pattern tends to have fewer fibroblastic foci than IPF. I don't know if that's true, or I don't know if anybody studied that. And then of course, cases that we're calling IPF might actually be HP. So there's no gold standard, right? Some of these cases in studies that are classified as IPF might be HP. We don't know. It's all up in the air. I thought BAL, I looked at BAL because in our MDD-ILD, they always want to know what the BAL lymphocytes are. Statement was that lymphocyte levels appear to vary inversely according to fibrosis burden in the lung. So the more fibrotic the lung is, then the less likely you're going to get increased lymphocytes that can point you to HP, I guess is how I could interpret that. So therefore the lack of BAL lymphocytosis does not rule out fibrotic HP. And then marked lymphocytosis with 40 to 60% lymphocytes is highly suggestive of HP and can help to exclude causes such as IPF. But what about CT connective tissue related disease? Don't they get high lymphocytes as well in their BAL? So, because that's another area of problem. I just included this, some of these. There's a good table in this review, which wasn't in the original reviews. Differential diagnosis of HP for the pathologist, a very long table with lots more than this. And I thought it was quite useful. I won't go through that. They make the point, so there's two things here. So plasma cells seem to be a big difference between connective tissue related disease and HP. Would people agree with that? If you see plasma cells, would you say, I don't think this is HP, because I must confess, I haven't used that plasma cells as a clue to HP versus connective tissue disease. If there's a lot of, I'll use it as a thing against IPF maybe, but if there's a lot of inflammation, my differential is more like HP and CTD, not, and I didn't think plasma cells were something useful. What do other people think?
I mean, I personally think they can be useful. As you say, everything's a soft sign, but I think if plasma cells are prevalent and kind of outnumber the lymphocytes, particularly if they're accompanied by lymphoid follicles with germinal centers, then I think you need to consider alternatives. I don't know how hard and fast a rule it is, but I think if the inflammatory infiltrate is predominantly plasma cells, there's some retrospectively collected case series that show that's more likely to be something other than HP.
Okay. And what about eosinophils? If you see eosinophils, I'm not talking about tons of them, but if there's, you know, maybe every field has got a few. What do people think about eosinophils in fibrotic lung disease? Because I did see a
few. You are fine.
Go ahead.
Yeah, I just said a few are fine. You know, if there's a lot of them, there's Sam's old paper on eosinophilic pneumonia in IPF patients. They still act like they have IPF. So, you know, if it's fibrotic, and then if it's cellular, it's sort of HP. So, you know, various studies, 10 to 15% of patients have eosinophils somewhere, even though they're not the dominant cell type.
For some reason, I seem to think if I see these eosinophils, I'm not looking for them and I keep noticing them. I kind of think that's more like connective tissue disease, but who knows?
Or drug toxicity, I guess, would start entering the differential potentially.
Sorry, what was that, Marie?
Drug toxicity could enter the differential potentially also?
Yeah, that's always in the differential. You've got to exclude that. And then I wasn't aware of this other line they put in there. Up to 10% of people with pleuroparenchymal fibroelastosis have features of HP. Am I the only person that didn't hear about this before?
Well, I think it's part of the kind of acknowledgement that anybody with anything can have associated changes, particularly in the upper lobes, that resemble PPFE, and whether that's really a mixed pattern or just acknowledgement that that histology is relatively nonspecific depends on how you want to use the language. But I think that's what that means. I wouldn't view it as how many people with PPFE have HP. I would view it as how many people with HP have findings that overlap with those seen in PPFE.
Yeah.
So I might flip it around.
Yeah, it might not be very significant at all. Yeah, okay. Thanks, Jeff. Any other comments? We've got, we're 8 o'clock already. So I won't keep you then. I thought this was a fun little paper. Bit of botany. And I like things that classify things properly. So now I know exactly what to call things. Seed storage cell granulomas. And don't use pulsed hyaline ring granulomas anymore. Well, I never did, but I think seed storage granuloma is a good terminology for this. It's a fun paper and some nice pictures. I'll let you all go. Thanks very much for the discussion.
Thank you.
Thank you, Margaret. Very good.
Thank you.